Can the use of song provide inspiration for a movement? How about the strength to oppose violent injustice? In this month's episode of the History Explorer podcast series, we'll learn about the use of freedom songs during the civil rights movement. Songs such as We Shall Overcome and This Little Light of Mine are well known, but did you know that even songs from 1960s pop music were incorporated into protest versions? We'll be speaking with Chris Wilson, the director of the program in African American culture here at the museum, who will talk about the use of music and song during the civil rights era, and how the songs are used in programs here on the museum's floor.
Okay, I'm Chris Wilson. I'm the director of the program in African American culture here at the museum, and also our daily programs department, which includes our theater programs.
Great. Now today we're going to be talking about freedom songs and how they were incorporated within the civil rights movement and or how they are used here at the museum for public programs. First off, could you talk a little bit about what freedom songs are?
Well, freedom songs were really, in some ways, the lifeblood or the soul force of the civil rights movement. They were involved in every part of the struggle, even the early days during the Montgomery bus boycott, and especially once students became involved in the 1960s, they attained an even more higher level of importance. Freedom songs generally came from the Black church traditions and involved a call and response style of singing, but toward once we got into the 1960s, the songs came from lots of different genres and areas of American and African American culture, and you started seeing popular songs even turned into freedom songs. What the songs really did was to give the protesters courage. Bernice Johnson Reagan, my predecessor here at the museum, who founded the program in African American culture, but started as a protester in Albany during the Albany movement in 1962 in Georgia, and she was one of the original Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee freedom singers, and since has become an academic and has studied the studied freedom songs. And as she says, she recounts at one point in a church in Albany, the sheriff and his deputies coming into the church and, you know, fear filling the room, because, as you know, everyone knew the sheriff and he knew their faces and their names, and they all knew he was there. Well, they started singing a song in this church, and as she said, the song let the sheriff know they were there, and the song gave people the power and the strength to stay in that room. It was the only thing that they could hold on to, because they knew, you know, that the power that in this case the sheriff had. And the song really filled up the room, she said, and pushed the fear out, and the song being the only thing that eventually remained in the room. So it gave people strength in that way, but it also gave people internal strength, but it also projected strength.
Now, you mentioned that some of these songs had roots in African American culture, and then some of them through popular culture. What were some of the songs?
Well, yes, the songs had roots in African American culture, and singing in protest and in solidarity had roots in wider American culture as well. Just quickly moving back, you can look at the Civil War period with both blacks and white soldiers, but you know, I can think of some examples of African American soldiers marching off to war and hoping that they would be allowed to get into combat and really free themselves. And there's a song there's a song called "We Look Like Men of War." There's a song where Sojourner Truth took the Battle Hymn of the Republic and changed the lyrics of that song to reflect colored Yankee soldiers going off to war. So that has a long history. The use of spirituals and call and response in slavery was certainly, you know, has a long history for African Americans. And in the Civil Rights Movement, those songs were again used in some of them, in some ways, in some examples, some of the same songs. So you saw songs like We Shall Not Be Moved, which was a song that had been used, it was older than the Civil Rights Movement, had been used as a protest song throughout its existence in the coal mines of West Virginia, for instance. And that was a song that was, if you will, repurposed and changed. Perhaps the most sung song in the Civil Rights Movement was the song This Little Light of Mine. One of my favorite examples of that is a version by a young song leader from Selma, Alabama, Betty Mae Fikes, who sings the song with such power and really reinvents it with in a way where she extends the kind of call to bring people into the song, and she leads them talking about where they lay out all the people who were fighting against them. So this was in Selma, where Jim Clark was the sheriff, who was a really powerful figure and a really frightening figure. And she says, tell Jim Clark I'm going to let it shine. Tell Governor Wallace, George Wallace, I'm going to let it shine. We Shall Overcome was the anthem of the Civil Rights Movement, or the signal song of the Civil Rights Movement, and sung quite often. But then again, popular songs. The program that we did last year called Sing for Freedom, we used a song called Fighting for My Rights, which was a song that was taken from a Ray Charles song called Lonely Avenue, which was a popular song at the time. And that song, Lonely Avenue, was then changed into Fighting for My Rights, and a song. Again, this is something that really the young people, the students, brought into the movement using some of the popular songs that they listened to on the radio and danced to at parties. Another Ray Charles song, and Ray Charles was particularly looked on with favor by the students in the movement because he refused to play segregated facilities. He refused to stay in segregated hotels when he traveled around the South, and he was, of course, one of the biggest stars at the time. And his famous song, Hit the Road, Jack, was changed by the students to Get Your Rights, Jack.
So how do you go about using these types of songs when you develop programs here at the museum?
Well, of course, here at the Smithsonian, we do have the kind of the access to and the legacy of Bernice Johnson Regan, who her collection is here in the archives and so forth. But everyone through Smithsonian Folkways has access to some of her research, an anthology called Voices of the Civil Rights Movement that she produced, which is an anthology of music from 1960 to 1966, available from Smithsonian Folkways. That is a great resource for the music, and these are actual recordings from the time period, great explanations of both musically and historically how these songs were used. When we're working on a program, we start with our our goals, our learning goals for our visitors, or and then we really dive into the content, into the research, listening to songs, just thinking about ways that we might get a point across. What we did with last year with our program, Sing for Freedom, we used, for instance, the song We Shall Not Be Moved, and we found recordings of it from West Virginia in 1930s, in the 1930s during labor organization for among coal miners, and we also found versions of it sung by grape pickers in Latino grape pickers in California in the mid 1960s, and so our cast prepared those versions as well as the version that would have been sung during the Civil Rights Movement, and we showed how one song can have these different lives and be used in struggle by different groups who bring their own cultural history to their singing of that song, but they're using it in the same way. So we, you know, we looked at that. We also try to make our presentations fun. And one of the things that you hear people, activists in the movement say, is that it wasn't, there were the moments where it was life and death, and there were moments where it was particularly serious, and of course the entire movement was serious business, but you know, part of a movement is this community that is created in the movement, and songs like the two Ray Charles songs I've mentioned show the camaraderie and the fun that might have been in the movement.
Now, how do visitors typically react when they hear these songs?
Visitors love these songs. One of the things I feel, one thing I think has changed in recent, you know, in the second half of the 20th century, once we have so much more media ability to, you know, easy ability to record music, easy ability to share music and so forth, is that music has turned in recent history much more into something that we buy rather than something that we all make mm-hmm. together. And we're in a period now, the Civil Rights Movement was that, and moving into the anti-war movement and so forth, was one of the last periods where we had really large numbers of people making music together, and now we think of it much more as, again, a commodity and something, you know, either we go to a concert to see or we purchase. Besides maybe sporting events and church, there's not a lot of places where Americans get together and sing anymore. The museum, so you'd think that it might be difficult to get people to mm-hmm. to in a museum like ours to get together and sing, but the Freedom Songs really do that. It's not difficult for us at all to get several hundred people singing We Shall Overcome or This Little Light of Mine together, even holding hands in Flag Hall here in the museum. And that speaks, I think, to the power of the song and the power of being in a communal place like this museum.
What do you think that the study of song and the study of music can teach people and students specifically about American history?
The music can really, looking at this music particularly, and I think, you know, you can transfer this to other types of music as well, but I think it really gives you a glimpse of the soul of that time. We've talked a bit about civil rights music, and that is certainly the case there. When you listen to we mentioned the song leader, Betty Mae Fikes in Selma, another song that I can recall of that she led was a song, If You Miss Me from the Back of the Bus. And the song talks about, if you miss me from the back of the bus and you can't find me, come to the front of the bus and I'll be sitting up there. But song leaders would change these lyrics all the time. In this case, she might say, if you miss a teacher. If you miss Mr. Johnson, you know, you can't find him nowhere. Come over to the school and you'll find him teaching there. But she, in Selma, took it even farther, where she was then laying out people like, again, Sheriff Jim Clark, where she was talking about the governor, George Wallace, and she says, if you miss George Wallace and you can't find him, come over to the crazy house and you'll find him over there. Come over to the funeral home or the graveyard and you'll find Jim Clark there, sort of. And that was something that it was rather uncommon in the civil rights movement to lay out your sort of enemies or your oppressors like that and suggest perhaps that you wish them to be taken away somewhere. Or... It speaks to how, and Betty Mayfix, when she was singing that, if you listen to the Smithsonian Folkways collection of this, she was 15 years old, and so it speaks to what this 15-year-old girl was thinking. But I think when you look at even more popular music, of the 19th century, music about baseball and so forth, you can really get glimpse of what was important to people and what type of humor those people had, not just the things that are important to them but just what they thought was funny, what they thought, what they spent their time doing, how they communicated with one another. I think the study of music in that way is really an essential part of understanding a different time period.
I'd like to thank Chris Wilson for taking the time to speak with us. For the History Explorer podcast series, this is Matt Ringelstetter. Join us again next month as we take another look behind the scenes here at the National Museum of American History. Funding for this podcast provided by the Verizon Foundation.